coming till you wake up on your own. I wonder where you are, and live with all your faults. I wanna wake up where you are. I won't say anything at all, so why don't you smile?
So it's Thursday, and we're gonna slide on into the Lynch Kenny Cosentini Hour. So joining me from McAllen, Texas is Tim Lynch. Tim, what's going on?
Not much, Matt. Glad to be here as usual.
All right. And from Kansas City, Kansas, Will Cosentini. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
I love that.
Close enough.
What do you mean close enough? That's what do you mean?
Kansas City's
a Missouri. Yeah, it's... I'm a little west of Kansas City, Kansas.
Oh, I didn't get the geography lesson sometime. I didn't get the suburb right.
No.
All right.
People here, you know, very tribal about their location. So
I know, but you're not from there. You're from the upstate New York. So why are you being tribal about it?
Listen, you say Kansas City, and all kinds of people get confused. We've seen it in national media. So.
All right. So what is the appropriate suburb now that we're hung up on it?
I actually live in Lenexa, Kansas.
Lenexa?
Yeah, it's just by Overland Park, but not Olathe. So that's where I am.
Got it. All right.
Just for all your listeners in the greater Kansas City metro area.
If they want to stop by.
Know.
If they want to stop by, you'll feed them and hang out. Sign autographs, all of that.
That's how we do. That's how we do things here in the Great Midwest.
You know what? This is kind of an aside. Let me introduce Jeff Kenny, and then we'll come back to you, Will. Jeff Kenny joins us from San Clemente, California. Jeff, how are you?
Good, real good.
That's great. Okay, back to Will. You've kind of taken to the Midwest, yes?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot here that I really like. If we could move this about 500 miles south, it'd be great. I'm not a big fan of winter anymore. But other than that, this is a great part of the world. I mean, people are wonderful. Kansas City is actually a pretty interesting place. There's a lot here to do, no matter what you like to do. So it's a good place. I do like it.
Yeah. Grew up in New York. Roamed around the world, and he likes the Midwest. Go figure. I will tell you, I mean, having lived in North Dakota, the people of the Midwest, and my own opinion, smaller town living is the best quality of life in the country. Doesn't get better than that. People are awesome. They give a shit about each other. And because the winners are what they are, you need each other. And that's a completely different vibration in a community. When you need each other, you pull each other out of the ditch, you shovel snow, you do things like that. And I'm partial to it, although I don't live there anymore. So anyway, I just wanted to draw that out of you, Will, as kind of a human interest type thing.
That was nicely done by our radio host.
Thank you. I'm still pissed at Lynch from last week. We were supposed to go like around the horn and talk about Jim Webb's. He says what he thinks about Jim Webb's, and then Lynch says, and then Lynch transitions the whole program. Hey, I want to know whatever he thinks about the Commandant's piece. And I was like, are you shitting me? Like, when did Lynch take over the program? So anyway, now I want to ask you guys this, because I had did an interview with Mike Etor, and it did not go. It got derailed by this question, so I'll ask you this question, and each one of you. We'll start with Jeff, because he hasn't said three words yet. When did you first know that you had leader in you? Is it something you knew when you were young? Teachers, coaches? When did it click for you that you had a little bit of leadership in you?
Well, I played junior football starting when I was 11 years old. And when we were getting our ass kicked, or even when we were winning, I was like always on fire. I just couldn't stand the idea of losing. And after a game, I would like be inconsolable. If I saw other football players like eating ice cream or something. I go, you fuckers, we don't deserve ice cream. We lost. And people like would respond to that. And then I had fist fights that got me thrown out of school almost in every grade from starting from my fifth grade year. And I attracted certain groups of dudes who thought, you know, because there's a lot of pushing and shoving and posturing when you're young. And I just didn't have that posture stuff in me then, you know. And then when I joined the Marine Corps, I'll tell you the truth, I just wanted to be a Marine. And the leadership stuff didn't really hit me until I got to Iran. I mean, I saw good leadership and I saw awful leadership in the time before I went overseas, which was about 11 months from the time I got out of boot camp. It's like worth a whole book itself about how awful the Marine Corps was. It was like an archipelago of prison camps across America in Japan, you know, and where you had to fight like a gladiator to hold on to your fucking pay. You know, they extort money from you and stuff. And but when I got to embassy duty and I ran into Gunnery Sergeant Stepp, he was the first guy I really started saying, you know, for some reason, these fucking assholes listen to what you say. So, and he schooled me, besides kicking me in the balls that time. And that was part of it. You know? And other things, you know, to the point where he was like the first really good example of, you know, leadership that made me want to be like. You know, the way it is with leadership is you get to one position and you think, I could do that. It's like I was listening to you and Mike today when I was PTing. And, you know, I remember having mostly great fucking lieutenants. But I remember thinking at a certain point, I could do this. And then when I got to be a lieutenant, we had a real good company commander in my first half of my first tour with 3-8. I was with 3-8 my whole time as a second and most of my time as a first lieutenant. We had a real good guy for the first part, and then I had a real not good guy for the second half. And, you know, it was good for me. And I think, you know, Will will say the same thing. The guy we had for Will's second half of his time in the fleet as a lieutenant, he was just perfect for us. Now, he wouldn't take shit, but at the same time, he let us, you know, he let us run a little bit, all of us lieutenants. And, you know, you could see yourself in certain roles. And we had our battalion commander was General Blackman. And before Blackman was a real hard guy, Will knows a lot better, named Bice. But my point is that you look up to the next level and there was a good guy there, you know? And so that really encouraged me. And then when they left, when you looked up to the next level, we had guys who weren't so good. And I thought, this is not a done deal. So much depends on leadership of one or two guys in key spots. So that's like how I really, you know, got into it.
Will, how about you? When were you a kid? When did the leadership thing kick in for you?
You know, I think that I figured out I could do it actually as a first class midshipman during plebe summer. So how it works at the Naval Academy, you
can I ask a stupid question? Is first sure. class is that a senior. Or a plebe?
Seniors,
a freshman.
Seniors.
Okay.
Seniors. So you go in there in plebe summer when you're a plebe, and it's misery, and it's supposed to be misery. And it's you know, you're not a galley slave or anything, but it's not a lot of fun. And the people that we had in charge of us seemed to glory in that it was not a lot of fun. And in my company, there's 42 of us that started in the company together, and you stay with those guys, and then you graduate in the same company with them. We had a hard time sort of getting it together, and I never got any inspiration from the first class who were in charge of us. And so then I did the plebe training and how that works as a first class. One set of guys does the first half of the summer, and then another set does the second half. So I did the second half of the summer, And I remember just some of the things that are misery, like drill. It was miserable. You go out and they just made it completely painful. And the squad leaders that I had, I was a platoon commander that summer. We said, hey, we've got to do this. And there's a certain amount of misery. But at the end of the summer, I really felt that the platoon that we had had performed really well on a lot of things. And they responded to positive sort of reinforcement. And we were more negative than I remember when I went through plebe summer on some things, but we had a lot of positive things. And I thought about that a lot because at the end of the summer, you know, the whole brigade has been gone for the summer doing various training, and they came in, and it was interesting to me to see the reaction to some of my peers and then some of the second class, the juniors, who were really involved in training plebes for the rest of the year, that this group that we had brought in, the fourth class in our company, really seemed to have a lot about them. And I said, you know, that was us. That was those three squad leaders and me figuring some things out to try and make this a better experience, to make them better midshipmen as opposed to just being miserable for the whole summer. And that, I learned a lot. Sort of as Jess says, reflecting on some of the negative leadership that I'd had when I went through there. And it carried a long ways for me. It was really the first time that I thought, you can shape things, even in your little part of it, where maybe you don't think you have a lot of maneuver room, you still do, because there's people that you're in charge of. So that was probably the first time for me.
Timmy, how about you? I mean, your dad's a general. I mean, he's an officer in the Marine Corps. When do you realize that this is what you want to do and that you could probably do it?
I think the leadership potential I experienced in high school, like Jeff. I was an athlete all through high school. I often would be captain of various teams. I was a good athlete and I was a big kid. So I naturally kind of I was always one of those guys that was going to either make up the team or was thrust in a position of some responsibility because of the athletic part of it. Then I do 6 years in the Navy where leadership is absent. I mean, it's I worked for some good doctors who taught me stuff, but I didn't understand military leadership wasn't even part of the equation. It was just a job. Literally, until except with the exception of Beirut, and just like Jeff, my experience in the Fleet Marine Force was mixed. My first, the first battalion that I deployed 1-9, I deployed twice with 1-9. The first deployment, not the most savvy outfit. Lots of problems that I could see as a second lieutenant. Our company commanders got replaced a couple times. It was really kind of sad. It wasn't all the companies. Bob Coates had Bravo Company. They were awesome, but they were the boat guys. You never saw them. And it wasn't until the second iteration that we got a battalion staff and some company commanders who were good. And then I experienced what it was like to be in an environment where leadership excellence is the expectation. And we had a tight battalion, and that was a happy, happy time. And that was the first time I saw the effect of positive leadership and so dramatically. It was a night and day difference between the attitude in a battalion, I felt.
Did you have Colonel Pratt?
No. This would have been Mize. This would have been right. Mize, Dave Mize, who came in. But it wasn't him. He bought in a three, Mike Lowe, who retired as a colonel. He was our monitor when I was lieutenant. Friggin' Mike Lowe was awesome. That guy was awesome, and he really was like the heart and soul of the battalion because he was so sociable. Colonel Mize was a reserve guy, nice guy, a quiet guy, you know, competent guy. But it was Lowe who seemingly ran the battalion as far as the leadership aspect of it went, and he was awesome, and he was funny, and it was a damn good time. There's nothing like being part of a tight unit because it's a happy place.
Yeah,
here's how small the Marine Corps is. Was a company officer at the Naval Academy when I was going through there as a major. The people in his company really liked him. It's not a great job. A lot of the job there is policing up the 10%. But Mize, you know, was just sort of known as one of those guys. You were lucky to have him as your company officer.
I grew up as, you know, one of those kids that I was good in sports, so I was a captain on teams and, you know, and organizing whatever we did at recess, I would organize it. All right, who wants to be the other captain? Lynch, okay, I got first pick. I got Will. And so, I mean, that was every day till we were in sixth grade and some kids from public school showed up and said, why does that kid get first pick every day? And everybody looks around and says, I don't know, that's just how we've done it since kindergarten. And I said, well, does somebody else want to do it? Yeah, I was like Vito Corleone. So, and I was always, you know, class president or something like that. And so, I mean, from the time I was a little guy, I mean, I just was in those roles. But in the Marine Corps, I remember, I don't know, I was still a second lieutenant, and I don't know what happened. And I remember just thinking, I'm not as stupid as they've told me I am. Like my instincts about what it is to be a leader and caring about people and doing the right thing are actually pretty good. And I need to follow my instincts more often. The first I was in 1-5, and then they were lat moving everybody out of their MOSs. So the light armored vehicle had just showed up, and I thought, well, maybe if I get into that community, maybe there's a chance I'll be able to retain my combat arms MOS. And you guys mentioned him last week, but Marty Steele was the battalion commander. He had just come from First Tanks. No, he would go to First Tanks after that. So he commanded two combat arms battalions. But he came, and I'd been in the battalion for a few months, and they had a softball team, and he knew I was a baseball player. And so he said, he called me in, he said, I want you to play on the softball team, and you know, you're going to be a shortstop. And I said, sir, I'd rather not. And he just looked at me like I was crazy. And he said, what? I said, I'd rather not. I didn't come in the Marine Corps to play, you know, sports. So I think that's, you know, the enlisted Marines should play that. I don't think officers should play. And he looked at me and he said, we're going to win everything in this division this year. And you're going to be the shortstop. Got it? And I said, yes, sir. And but he called me into his office one day and he looked at me and he said, you can be a good officer in this Marine Corps if you want to. And I said, huh? And, but you know, and when somebody like that looks at you and says, you could be good at this, I mean, I thought I could, but I remember after that going, you know, I could probably do this, but it's interesting how it clicks in different settings. And Mike, you know, Mike Etor told the story about being a fat kid and I thought he was just being facetious, but he wasn't. He said, oh no, I was fat. But it was just an interesting conversation because, you know, you spend your life being a leader, but, you know, none of us start out like that. And so I thought it's interesting. Let's talk about Afghanistan. Afghanistan power sharing agreement last week since we've spoken. And that was a major stumbling block. The Secretary of State has been over there a few times trying to encourage people to let's get our shit together. And it seems like the Trump administration wants out of there. Officially, All Marine Radio is cautiously pessimistic about Afghanistan. And let's talk about it. Let's talk about the residual force and if you change your thoughts relative to, you know, cautiously pessimistic. Timmy, start with you. Your thoughts on Afghanistan. Residual force, current events, what do you think? You got to unmute yourself, man.
Yeah, I do. I do. Thanks, Mac. I retain my cautiously pessimistic reading on that. This power sharing agreement is identical to what they did the last time. It's not good because there's only one president. They allowed Abdullah to be head of the reconciliation committee to deal with the Taliban. That's not a, you can't share the presidency. It's a one man job. So that's going to promote the same divisiveness it did the last 4 years. And we're going to continue to see Afghanistan unravel. The only reason they agreed was we pulled $1 billion from them, and they've got to do this in order to keep the money flow to stay alive. It's not good. The Taliban have continued the pressure. Obviously, they lost a bunch up in Kunduz yesterday, but that they've always, for what that's worth. And after Eid, which starts, I think, tomorrow, after Eid, they've declared war on India. They're going to jihad against India because India has been harsh on the Kashmiris. So that place is worse than it was. And when we talk about a residual force, 8 years ago, when I had been living in Afghanistan,
before you go to residual force, explain to everybody what Eid is.
Eid is the end of Ramadan. Eid is the end of Ramadan. So Ramadan is a month long, a period where Muslims fast from sunup until sundown, and then at the end of the fast, which is declared by the imams looking at the moon, and they're constantly arguing about which day it starts. Often Pakistan will start a day early. But at that, when the imams deem that the proper moon phase is there, then they break the Eid fast, and they break the fast, the Ramadan fast, and that's a week long celebration. It's a week of Christmas in Afghanistan, essentially. I mean, Eid is like seven Christmases in a row.
Got it.
It's like it's tea, kebabs, and pederasty.
All right. Residual force to me. Thoughts on that?
Okay. My only thoughts are this. About 8 years ago, when I've been living in Afghanistan for 8 years, I had a very good read for the place. I had an intuitive understanding for the atmospherics of the local people. That's long gone. I don't have a feeling for the place. But if you're going to leave the tier one hitters behind, supposedly to keep an eye on these potential other terroristic threats, that makes me very nervous, because they're not going to have the human intelligence they need to safely go at any kind of distance in that country and do something, because what the Taliban is going to do, they're going to lure them out and they're going to wipe them out. That's what they've been trying to do since 2009. And once they do it, we're gone. And I've been afraid of this for 5 years now. And I don't like the idea of leaving anybody behind, quite frankly. The Afghans can take care of themselves. They've got to figure this out for themselves. But any type of residual force is going to have a degraded intelligence capability and are going to be blind to what's happening outside of their outside of their immediate environment. And you cannot compensate with SIGINT and ISR. It doesn't work. Without that kind of detailed human intelligence, they're going to be set up for failure. And I just don't see how that possibly is in our best interest to remain.
That's essentially how we're doing it now. Well, I don't know. I don't know either. I mean, we've certainly done a lot of human SIGINT, and that's driven a lot of operations over the course of the last two decades.
Mm-hmm. It has, but the human's been degrading, and the lack of human was a problem with all the I don't want to count up the number of raids that hit the wrong compounds, but they're over 100. I mean, there's several hundred of those, and each one of those is a little mini disaster. Oftentimes, because we got good at it, nobody was killed, but at first they were, and we did ourselves no favors by continuing this night raid, because as I pointed out, I was arguing with this with Paul Kennedy, as a matter of fact, when he was there. I was arguing with him. I said, look, dude, every year they're getting stronger, and you say every year you're taking their leadership out and they're going to get weaker. And it's not working. So I don't know who you're taking out, but it's not important, guys. And I don't think that's going to – I think that just that carries on. We never seem to get at the important guys, because those assholes are over in Pakistan, where we should have been hunting them to begin with. But that's neither here nor there.
All right. Well, your thoughts on residual, your general sentiment relative to Afghanistan, and your thought about residual force.
Yeah, my sentiment is we had it right in 2002. Punitive campaign. We conducted a punitive campaign, and after that, what is our interest in Afghanistan? Our interest in Afghanistan is to never hear the word Afghanistan again. And that seems to remain our interest, but we can't put that out in public. And so I'm searching for the power sharing agreement in the course of human history that's worked out well.
Right. Never.
And maybe there is. Okay, so my history professor, Mr. Kenny, says never. I agree with him. And so residual force to do what? I don't know. I don't know what our objective of that force is on a, other than maybe as a face saving, and then we get out the door at some other point. But if it's going to be the point effort of a future punitive campaign, then maybe it's worth an investment. But the idea that that force is going to have anything to do with the flowering of Afghanistan into being a great and staunch ally in the middle of the wastes of Central Asia is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And so I don't know what it's going to cost us in blood or treasure. So it's really hard for me to say what it's going to be worth. I will say there's not, 20 people in the United States that care, other than the people that are related to anyone who's going to be in the residual force. I mean, I can't remember a conversation outside the Beltway about Afghanistan.
Where a civilian walked up to you and said, "Hey, man, I'm really interested in Afghanistan, and it really concerns me." Did somebody walked up to you and said that?
I've never had one of those. You know, look at any number of websites that you read the news on, you know, sort of general news. It's talk about it not being above the fold. It's not even in the A section. Right. I just don't see it.
Jeff?
Yeah, I agree with Will. I agree with Will about that 2002 thing, because that's when we went to hell with stupid decisions. The thing was pretty much for our interests subsequent to 9/11.
Okay, hold on. Let me just interject this, because I was talking to somebody about this today. They said, "Well, look, when we go back to 2002, one of the things that was said was, you know, one of the problems with Afghanistan is when it struggled, you know, people go in and they wipe it out, but they don't help it reconstruct itself. And that was our initial, you know, that was our initial thrust. We were going to help Afghanistan, you know, rebuild
itself." That's not true, though.
It's not
historically true. People say that, but they ignore history, you know. Afghanistan's like a rubber country. It hasn't always been in that configuration. Right now, there's 34 provinces, and then they're in that. It's never been so firm as it is now. Not one piece of Afghanistan's going to any other country since 2001. Partially because people don't want it, but I have to tell you, we've done the exact wrong things in Afghanistan. Like, for instance, we tried to, as the war in Iraq went on, there was moves within DOD to make Afghanistan like the alternate deployment spot to get your battalion command in combat. And so we created a counterinsurgency where there was really none. And I saw personally, and I know Tim was right there with me, we saw that they had this outfit of Army National Guard guys from Georgia who were being well used by the Afghan army and their advisors, and that they were like mortarmen and like heavy gunners and stuff like that, who would support ops within the area. As a matter of fact, Ganjigal, the famous Ganjigal, had like 4 120 mortars manned by these dudes. And they decided to give the battalion commander, as a reward for being a good reserve battalion commander in the army, they decided to give him battle space, which they did in Nangarhar, which promptly had been a peaceful place. But after a couple of weeks of army dudes driving around and forcing people off the roads and telling people what's what and everything, actually shooting at cars and stuff, they, before you know it, the Taliban shows up. You know what I'm talking about, Tim? Remember that Georgia bunch?
And I not only know what you're talking about, I had cars shot out from under me by army before. I mean, I cannot tell you how pissed I was about how they were conducting business in Nangarhar. I just try not to bring up too much because I sound too bitter.
Okay,
that's right. It's the opposite problem that we're having in Iraq at the same time.
Okay.
We had places that were peaceful.
I know.
That we'd show up to do this thing, and then all of a sudden now there's a counterinsurgency there.
Got it. Okay, relate this to residual force, though.
Okay, well, because of that, the reason right now that we got a big, huge Afghan National Army, which is matched by a huge national police force and also local police. And I was there in 2017 as a counter-corruption advisor of all things, and I saw the people who actually – and it hit me then, the big problem. There ain't no national sense in Afghanistan. They don't see themselves. The only people who fight for Afghanistan are the people who are fighting for the area they live in. So it's they're never going to pony up to be the force that they were designed to be. They outnumber the Taliban. They outgun the Taliban. They have pensions. They have regular pay. They have medical service. They have all kinds of stuff they don't have, and they've lost almost everything. It wouldn't be a coin fight if they went in there now and fought. It would be a conventional fight. When I was there, Roger Turner was the brigadier general in charge, and he's an aggressive guy. He decides we're going to take back we're going to take back Garmsir. We're going to take back Marja. We're going to take back Sangin. And he starts making plans with the ANA. They would not pony up. The guys who were doing it were the local cops. And why? Because the dope corners would have belonged to them then. I mean, it's so bad.
You know? Okay, so bad. We're talking about
now, residual force. I mean, I'm getting to it.
All right.
We got to tell them, first of all, look, we're out of here. We've done enough for you guys. And you go through the whole thing again. Proven, even your intel, our intel says you outnumber, outgun. You're better off than these guys. There's no reason why you're not kicking it. No reason why you're not like Switzerland here, except for you. So here's the deal. You know, the Resolute Support has like 17 different agencies, like organizations under the flag of Resolute Support. Everything from female suffrage to female cops to agriculture, all that shit needs to go. It needs to go. The idea that America and Europe are such perfect societies, we can go there and make them be like us, it's just not happening. And matter of fact, it encourages the Taliban. It's the reason ISIS is in there now, because of that stuff. You get rid of that. We tell them that's gone. All the money and everything that you guys get for this project and that project, United States not doing it anymore. If you're going to get it, you're going to get it from either NGOs or you're going to pay for it yourself. But we'll keep 7,000 volunteers here, and they're going to advise your Afghan army and your national police. We're going to teach you son of a bitches how to do indirect fire again for the 40th fucking time. What happened with the other guys we taught indirect fire? They got bribed away by the Taliban to shoot rockets at bases and shoot fucking mortars and stuff like that at us because they got outpaid. They pay more. Or they just got jobs doing something, you know, that would pass for technical in India. And you say this to me, say, look, and here's – and after a year, if you guys haven't taken back a appreciable amount of territory, we're gone. We're gone. Because you guys – and you know what happens is – and I was one of them for a long time. You get these advisors going there, and you start sympathizing with the Afghans. Well, you know, they don't have pensions like us and everything. Now my attitude is, fuck you. That's your problem. You know what I mean? If you want that shit, you fight it out, you get it. I'll tell you right now, the most patriotic Afghan in the 2nd Brigade of the 201st Corps in Afghanistan 2009-2010 was Jeff Kenney. And I'll tell you what, the most patriotic American in 1778 wasn't Baron von Steuben or Lafayette. There's a bunch of Americans who had that job. And, you know, that's the fucking problem right there. They don't see themselves as a nation. And it's a big joke to them, especially when we get guys getting killed. You know, there's a big thing about Americans, particularly military guys, that think they feel guilty for the stuff we have. And that somehow we need to apologize to these people who are supporting, who aren't as fortunate as us. That's the weakest shit there is. So I say residual force, 7,000 guys, all volunteers. And your fucking your golden hour is only there if the Afghans provide it, because they got helos. You're wearing Afghan uniforms that say USMC on them. You're shooting their mortars and their arty. That's what's going to save your ass. And you accompany those motherfuckers. You don't stay on a fob and give them little reports you got from your fucking satellites and shit. You're out with them. It's not perfect. It's pretty goddamn dangerous. And I'll tell you now, I know we won't do it. We just don't have it in us anymore. It's not the Afghans who are the problem. It's us that's the problem and how we went at this thing. Because everybody looks at a problem now and says, how does this fit my agenda? Not like, how do I help solve the problem? Look at the coronavirus thing.
Hold on before we go there.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? My point is this. We got to, and it won't happen. The point is this, that, you know, we got to look at the problem, say, this is what needs to be done. We got to make it so these guys do it, and we give them enough help to maybe that it will work. But, you know, it's got to be them, and that's what's been missing. The onus is on them.
If I could interject.
Go ahead.
The point of that, too, is that our interest is we don't want it to be, you know, a hotbed of future terrors. Right. Just tell them. Remember 2002?
Yeah.
We'll come back. We'll do it again in 3 months. And then we're going to leave again. We're not going to do it for 19 years. And if we got to go back there for 3 months every 20 years, it's a hell of a lot cheaper than any other thing I can figure out. And it's actually aligned with what our interests are.
All right. Yep. When I went back to cover the Marine Corps Marathon a couple of years ago, and I bumped into somebody that we all know, and I said, "Hey, could you explain to me Afghanistan?" And he said, "Sure." And he said, "A couple of things. One, strategic presence in the region. We don't have one, so that's one. Two, it's a term insurance policy. With a residual force there, we can keep ISIS and Al Qaeda from staging operations there and using it as a base. And that's, as long as we pay for that with our residual force, that's where our interests are. And that's what we can do with the residual force. We could prop them up if we need to, but the American public has had enough, you know, to Will's point, of casualties, and Jeff made it too. They do not, once we go to that phase, they do not want to see Marines or soldiers or airmen coming home in body bags because they were out advising and got their ship blown up. In the rarest exceptions, you know, we would intercede, we would maybe rescue somebody, but most of it's going to be supporting arms, you know, and special operations. And everybody else going to hang out on a firm base and focus on the strategic missions. And there are two. One is a presence in the region. Two is ISIS, Al-Qaeda denial. And that's the term insurance policy that we can provide the country.
So if they're the leading edge of a future punitive campaign, I can buy that. Other than that, the idea that we're going to do anything to win the war is ridiculous.
Okay, let me ask you a follow-up question. Timmy, you go first. Does the COVID-19 hasten the end of this because of the fiscal pressure that's going to be felt by the DOD?
Without question, it's going to hasten the end of this. And it's also going to affect the donors, the other countries who donate money to keep Afghanistan going. It's 70% of the funds, I'm guessing, but I'm probably close. 70% come from us, 30% from other countries. But we're talking billions, and those billions are not there because we've shut our economies down.
Yeah.
Jeff?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's absolutely true. The Afghans didn't collapse after the Russians left until the Russians stopped paying their salaries. And then I'll tell you right now, all these Afghan high-ranking people, they got houses in Dubai, they got places in India. If we leave, they're right behind us. And you know what? Maybe that's not bad. It's horrible, but you know what I'm saying? Maybe that's the way, you know, it's supposed to be, because we got out of Afghanistan what we wanted to. You know, the Taliban protected Al Qaeda. went in there, kicked the shit out of them for it. Pretty snazzy way they did it too. CIA dudes, special forces guys, dropping B-52 arc lights on top of them. You know, they would concentrate to meet the Northern Alliance. The Taliban would. They'd get the shit blown out of them, and it was pretty good. And they ruined it. They ruined it. You know, big government ruined Afghanistan. And so, yeah, I agree with Tim on that one.
Well, yeah.
Hey Matt, what's the budget for the residual force?
I don't know.
Because in the end, if it's not, I mean, the Pentagon budget, 700 odd billion.
Right.
You know, if we leave 7,000 people and, you know, what are they going to cost? If they cost $1 million a piece, what's that, $7 billion?
Yeah.
That's budget dust in the Pentagon. That may be an excuse, but in reality, you know, they got a furnace in the middle of the Pentagon. They throw bales, $100 bills in. It'd take a long time to burn $7 billion. It's nothing compared to the overall budget. So they just ginned up $4 trillion 3 weeks ago and $3 trillion last week. Yeah. $7 or $10 or $15 billion in Afghanistan is not what's going to force us out. And your point of the American public doesn't want to. The American public has no idea. You could poll 1,000 people on the streets across the United States and ask if we've got anyone in Afghanistan. And if we do, how many people are there? You wouldn't get within an order of magnitude of the right answer. So I don't disagree. I'm not sure about the whole presence in the region, but the idea that there would be the point effort on a future punitive campaign, maybe, you know, and it might be worth an investment of $5 or $10 billion.
We zero in a bunch of LZs and a bunch of, you know, we have a lot of, pre-staged line charges and shit in there, but we're out of there. You know, I have to tell you, there's a great quote by Frederick Roberts, Lord Roberts, who led the second Afghan war, the Brits in the 1881. And he has a great quote about being in Afghanistan. And I don't remember exactly. I was going to look for it and have it ready, but it's easy to find, right? But he says basically, you know, because there's pressure in England to stay there, because if Britain didn't stay in there, then the Russians would come in. No shit. And, this, you know, because there's a great game. You guys know the great games. You know, the whole of Asia was at play between the Russians and the Brits. And, you know, he said, you know, I think the Afghans will hate us the less they see us, you know. And he said, and, you know, if the Afghans, and I'm really paraphrasing here, if the Russians go into Afghanistan, then the disadvantage will be still on the Russians, because they'll be in Afghanistan trying to deal with what we've been dealing with in the late 1830s, early 1840s. And then in the 1870s, you know, he basically said, you know, it's easy to get into Afghanistan. It's not easy to try and make Afghanistan a place you want to stay, you know, but easy to get in, easy to get out. And like Will was saying, you know, we can show our fucking manliness and kick the shit out of people for a while and then say we're leaving here for the same reasons, the real reasons. The Greeks left and the Mongols left and the Persians left. And the Brits and the Russians, and why we're going to probably leave, is because people come to the conclusion that the fucking juice ain't worth the squeeze.
The budget, the DOD requested a $14 billion budget for fiscal year 21, which is the lowest amount.
That is budget dust.
Right.
That's budget dust.
Right. That is the lowest amount.
In the Pentagon.
Got it. So we're still... are we beyond cautiously pessimistic now, given the COVID thing?
I think you are wildly optimistic to think that we should be cautiously pessimistic.
I'm with Vito on that one. We got to go down a notch.
So we're no longer cautious. We're ruthlessly pessimistic.
I think just pessimistic.
We're enthusiastically pessimistic. Enthusiastically pessimistic about Afghanistan?
Yeah, some people say the glass is half full, some say it's half empty. I say it's broken with a couple of drops of dirty water at best.
Yeah. But, you know, once you're in there, I mean, it's addicting. I mean, if somebody offered me, hey, Jeff, you want to go back and just spend 6 weeks, you know, up there and, you know, by Korngal, you know, and I think, you know, we can – all we want you to do is just, you know, develop this one little force of dudes up there. 6 weeks? Because it's a seductive place, you know. It's hard to explain, but, you know, you guys know, you know, it's like you think maybe we can do a little bit of good this next time.
It's not that seductive, okay? That's not the right word. Okay?
I don't mean it's nice. I mean it's like – No, you know, it's kind of like a Rubik's cube. No. I don't know what I'm talking about.
I think Jeff would be right if he had had my experience, because I had, like, I didn't make my bed or clean my bathroom or any of that stuff. I had servants. It was like living in another era.
You're like Richard Burton, man.
I know.
Well, yeah, yeah. I mean, it was nice being the Kang, the Kang of Kang District, but it is a seductive place. But it's no place for Americans these days.
All right, let's talk about the Navy. 100-meter, you know, radius now around American warships in the Persian Gulf. And so my question to you three is this, and we'll start with Will, because he's a Navy guy, he's a Naval Academy guy, so he would be the expert here on things nautical with Doc Lynch right behind him. Somebody violates 100 meters. Navy going to cut loose on him?
With what? 25 millimeter? That's 25. What they got on those destroyers. And so what's – when I read about that, I'm trying to think out what is the point of what we're trying to do here? Because they know we have inherent right to self-defense, inherent obligation of self-defense. Right.
But do we know that?
And they keep pushing it and pushing it. And it's, you know, first, I mean, think of the mechanics of it. There's a guy sitting out there in that 25 millimeter, or even worse, a sailor with a rifle. That's a frightening thought. So someone breaches the 100 meter line. How do you get the command? You're going to have, you know, ROE green at 100 meters? I don't think so.
Right.
It's got nothing to do with tactics. It's got to do with
right.
the strategy of what we're trying to accomplish there. And
you hit the nail on the head. You said a sailor with a rifle. He's going to say, I didn't think you really meant that. I thought it was like one of those mail buoy things, you know?
So
yeah. We're
trying to message. We're trying to message these guys that we're serious. No, we're really, really serious.
Right.
Think, but I'm not sure. It'd be better yet if an Iranian speedboat broaches the 100 meter line. We take one of Jeff's arc light and drop it into the boat basin where the rest of the boats are and the commander.
Yeah, that's better.
That would tell them that we're serious about this.
Right.
Having a sailor with an M16 shoot at them?
You're right. Sends a message. It'll ruin a guy. It's like, you know, I was thinking about this today when we're thinking about this. I'm thinking, you know, how do you send a message? And what Will just said, kind of like, I'm thinking about the Entebbe raid when the Israelis freed those people in that Lufthansa plane that the terrorists took down to, Uganda. And I remember on the whole time they're doing this thing, the Israelis used to advise the Ugandans before the Ugandans went Soviet, you know, and they had an Israeli dude who knew Idi Amin on the phone the whole time. And he's, while they're doing the raid, he's talking to him. And then Amin is getting, hey, this happened. The Israelis are in. You were there. I was there. What do you mean? Yeah, there's some guy in a limousine, you know, and all our guys are dead. Oh, and all our MiGs are blown up. And the last thing he said before he hung up on the Israeli was, "Why did you? You didn't have to blow up all my MiGs." But instead of
Think about if you're in charge of China right now, I would be paying Iranian speedboats, to breach the 100 meter line. Right? We don't want to set something off in the Straits of Hormuz. We don't want to get into a tit for tat with Iran. So if we do anything, it should be massive to let them know we're serious. Don't mess with us. But if we get into this, so they broach 100 meters, so we shot at them. Right. And then 2 days later, it's completely distracting. It's totally against
so
what we say, our strategy, pivot.
Okay, hold on. All right.
I don't know.
Let me, Timmy, hop in here. You're a veteran in the United States Navy. What's the point of this?
Okay, this is a political move that's designed to make us look like we're going to stand up and put our foot down, which we don't. I mean, we'll hit it right on the head. What weapon system do we have that's effective at 100 meters? That's a little bit damn close. I mean, how the hell do you even figure what 100 meters is when you're on the ocean? It's kind of difficult getting distances judged when you're on the water. But that bullshit aside, this is a dumb move because we don't even have weapon systems appropriate to hit people that close. That's a little too close to let people
hit. Wait, hold on. They have 25 millimeter chain guns on those things.
That Sea Whiz doesn't.
No. They're manned.
Yeah.
No, but regardless of the weapons, I think it's just dumb. If you know you got speedboats running around an aircraft carrier, what do you care? If these guys come with 100, who the hell cares? If you got a small little frigate or destroyer, you can run donuts around those boats and cause them to broach. I saw them do that on a Navy, do that on some stupid Navy fighting pirates thing 10 years ago where right. This Navy ship captain just got tired of it and he ran donuts around the pirates until they got dunked in the water. Then he had to rescue them. I mean, there's a ton of ways of doing it, but I don't think saying you're going to shoot them at 100 meters.
Since the Cole, they got they do have small arms. They have mounts for everything from Mod Deuces and the 25 Mike's right. You know, I spent more time at sea in that last job I had as the SOTG guy for TUMEF than I had since 2004, 2005 when I was the 3 of the MU. And I was on every big deck and all of them had all kind of extra mounts they didn't have in the old days. And right. I think it was because of the coal.
And that's funny because in 87, when we were going through the Straits of Malacca, the Navy wanted us to put our machine gunners up on the, outside the
Stinger guys too.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the Marines were like, okay, you got any mounts for it? And the guys are like, what do you mean mounts? We got mounts for the machine guns. And he goes, no, you can shoot them from your hip. And our three goes, where'd you see that done? And the guy said, rant. Oh,
no, stop.
Oh, just you can't stop. Do that, huh?
Stop. No, we actually, when I was the XO of the Martin on the Ranger for we were up in the North Arabian Sea forever and for about 105 straight days. And, it was great for the Marines. We sandbagged all the sponsons, put up the 50 cals, and they were outside, got fresh air, and it was good for them. And but now they have, and they have shock absorbers on their gun mounts and they pretty cool stuff. But I just, the Navy. So somebody comes. What they tend to do is they play the ROE game with you, which is they're driving at you fast, but their weapons are all pointed aft. Right. So they're screwing with you, but they know that your ROE probably better than a lot of your guys do. And I just don't see the Navy smoking one of these boats, in spite of their 100-meter line. And so I guess that's –
And if we do, then what?
Exactly.
Then what?
Well, then we're waiting for, a response like we did after we killed Mosegada there, or Soleimani. I mean, then, you're just waiting for the tit to come.
The next question. Final question. We've been going for about 54 minutes now. Your thought of the week. Will, your thought of the week. Any thought in your head that you've, whether it's DOD or not?
You know, actually, something I wanted to ask. What are people reading right now? What are good books out there? I'm actually reading a pretty good book by a guy who's written about World War II, and it's a history of the Pacific, but it starts in China. I think the guy's name is Franks. It's called Tower of Skulls. Interesting, because some of the stuff about China that occurred in the 30s is reverberating now. So, you know, what are you reading while you're stuck in Modlock?
Tower of Skulls. What does that refer to?
Allow me, please. That was a comment made by an intellectual talking to the Japanese, a German, saying that you will end up building an empire on a tower of skulls, something like that. Am I close to
there? There you go. You are. You're exactly right.
You're a smart cookie, Tim.
No, I read that. I was talking to Mac about that. I read that book last month, and I'm on the Second World Wars, Victor Davis Hanson. Another awesome book.
Great book.
All right. I wrote because I interviewed him, I read Joe Galloway's book called They Were Soldiers, and interviewed him. But I'm in the process of reading Why America Loses Wars, Limited War, and U.S. Strategy from Korea to the Present, that was recommended to me. So I'm reading that. Yeah.
Hey, can I throw out another one that it was the darkest book I've ever read, and it was called Breakout at Stalingrad by Heinrich Gerlach. This was a manuscript that the Russians confiscated from him when he was released in the 1950s, and he was released, tried to reconstruct the book and failed. He published it, but it wasn't that good. But this Breakout of Stalingrad, it's about the army as it dies and goes into captivity. Man, it is grim. I mean, the stuff that guy's writing about, it's one place you wouldn't want to be. It makes the forgotten soldier seem tame in comparison.
Yeah, 600,000.
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah. I think about 10,000 of them got repatriated late in the
– Yeah, that's it. Only about 10,000 out of the 90,000 who surrendered. Yeah.
Right. But it's an amazing study because he's follows several characters. It's a novel, obviously. He's a general staff officer.
That was the Soviet way. You know, we actually had some pilots from the Doolittle raid who made it all the way to, the Soviet-occupied territories there in Mongolia, and they kept him prisoner for a year. These are guys the Soviets did, and they did it for some of our pilots from the 8th Air Force who were bombing Germany, who, got shot down, ended up in the eastern area. And the Russians kept them till the end of the war. They just kept them. What the fuck, man?
Just thank God that they were allies. I mean, if they weren't allies, they'd have been there for, 20 years like the Germans were.
Yeah. I'm reading this book now about Richard Burton by Byron Farwell. One of my favorite authors, Richard Burton, the guy who basically all over Afghanistan and a bunch of other stuff, explorer and everything. So it's interesting to me. And one thing I want to bring up, his dad was an army officer, professional army officer, and was interested in medical stuff. But, a lot of these officers didn't have much to do in the army. It was occupation duty or, they put him on half pay because they didn't have anything for him to do. So this guy in the 1820s got into an argument with another officer. He had a duel, and he shoots the guy. But because he wasn't he was blunt and kind of rude, but he wasn't like a bully or anything like that. He shoots the guy, but he doesn't kill him. He nurses the guy back to health. And the guys, now they're friends, but they get into another argument. The guy challenges him to a duel again, and this time he kills him. I remember thinking, that's English. That's the Englishman for you, And so there's that book, which is very interesting. It's Byron Farwell, he wrote like Queen Victoria's Little Soldiers and eminent Victorian, soldiers about fighting basically in the 19th century, trying to hang on to the emperor, everything from the Zulu Wars to fighting in Afghanistan and India and so forth. But while I'm doing this, I stumble across on TV a show about Robin Olds, this Air Force pilot.
Oh, yeah. Great, Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about, Will? This guy was something else.
He's got a book out that his daughter took all of his diaries and wrote a book out of it. Really good book.
This guy, it's like up there with like when we were talking about the last can stand of the Tin Can Sailors. Not as desperate, but the guy was something else. I mean, he destroyed half the North Vietnamese Air Force, which is about 20 planes. You know, actually, the whole Air Force is about 20 MiGs. And this show I was watching, it really went. I'll find out. I'll text it to you guys what the exact name it was. But this guy figured out a way. The 105s were flying in from Thailand, and then they had the F-4s behind them, and he's a F-4 fighter pilot guy. And the North Vietnamese had it timed exactly, and they'd come down, shoot the fuck out of these 105s, knock them down, and by the time the F-4 showed up, they were gone. They had no match to the F-4s. So he figured out a way to disguise the F-4s signature and put them in with the 105. It seems like and they really worked out this plan, and it worked pretty good. But it was a wild dog fight. I didn't even know. I know there was some dog fighting in the Vietnam War, but this thing really. And this guy Olds is when the Air Force was good. You know, the guys who were veterans in the Army Air Corps. You know, this guy was. It's very interesting.
Yeah, he. I think he was class of 41 from West Point. Right. By the end of the war, he was a fighter squadron commander. With 4 years in grade, 4 years in service total. So,
yeah, colonel.
The guy in the Air Force.
Yeah.
All right. Timmy, final thought? Unmute yourself, bro.
This is getting to be annoying. I'm doing this every
time. It was annoying 4 weeks ago. Now I don't even know what to say about it.
I know, Jesus. No. My final thoughts are: I continue to be amazed at the two polar opposites in the American public over this COVID-19. You know, the blue state. We've got to stay locked down until there's a vaccine, which is not going to happen anytime soon. Mm-hmm. And versus the red state, open them up. And I the more I watch the pro close forever. Politicians doubling down, the more amazed I am at what we're seeing. I think we're seeing things are going to change after this greatly. And I'm fascinated to see how it's going to change.
Jeff, final thought? Or anybody, Will, anybody, Jeff, thoughts about that?
Yeah, I agree 100%. I think this is ridiculous in the extreme. We've never, for any kind of pandemic or any kind of medical emergency, have we ever quarantined ourselves. What you do is you quarantine the at-risk folks and you just go on about your business, you know, and this quarantine things end up being worse in the long run. You know, it's like it's insane to save thousands of people. We're going to ruin millions of lives. It's crazy and stupid. And
well, you know what's amazing about it? We've never been in a position to be able to do this, and right? Yeah. I mean, right. You could never have implemented any of this. You couldn't monitor people. You couldn't communicate on a detailed, massive scale like this. You could never implement something like this via what, the newspaper? You know, via the public service announcements. Now it's Orwellian, and I'm not, you know, something that Will said either last week or the week before, and that is, to me, it's amazing how people just you're all right.
Yeah, I know.
And they taken almost 3 months for people to say, "Hey, fuck you!" If Home Depot can be open and I follow the same rules as Home Depot, why can't I be fucking open?
Right.
So
exactly right.
Two things on this. You know, people say, "Oh, there's been civil unrest." No, there hasn't.
Oh God,
there's been what, two protests in Michigan and one there. You want to see civil unrest? You know, 1968 in the United States.
Yeah, flipping through Life magazine. Mario Savio on the front in Berkeley with a fucking fire lit behind him. Flipping the bird off, right? With 80,000 people demonstrating. That's civil disobedience.
Yeah. The other thing I would say is, you know, you saw the Senate testimony with Fauci and Rand Paul last week. And Rand Paul missed an opportunity because he said something, you know, Fauci, you're not all that. And right. Fauci said, well, I've never said I was all that. I'm a scientist, I'm a doctor, and I'm a public health official. Well, you're not a public health official. You're very narrowly focused on the virus. Because right. a true public health official would have looked at the entire portfolio of public health to include 120,000 people a month in the U.S. get diagnosed with cancer that haven't been diagnosed in the last month and a half.
Yeah.
Plus all the other negative consequences of its significant economic downturn. So I actually thought we were going to go for over an hour without talking about COVID, but both Jeff and Tim wormed it into your program.
Yeah, you can't get away from it. You can't get away from it. Jeff, final thought?
That's it. I'm out of thoughts. My mind's blank. My mind's like Helmand Province. There's nothing on it but busted vehicles and shitty fucking piles of Afghan shit.
Based on something Will said, I reached out to Lynn Wells via LinkedIn because I have Lynn Wells in my head now. And for those of you who don't know, Will brought up a memo that he had seen circulated, and the dude who wrote it to then SecDef Donald Rumsfeld, and it dealt with predicting the future. In fact, the title is Predicting the Future. And then you had the Secretary of Defense, who I'm not particularly a fan of, forward it to the President of the United States, and he CCs Dick Cheney and Condoleezza Rice on it. And it talks about the 2001 Quadrennial Defense Review, and then it kind of walks you through history. If you had been a security policymaker in the world's greatest power in 1900, you would have been a Brit, looking warily at your age-old enemy, France. By 1910, you'd be allied with France, and your enemy would be Germany. By 1920, World War I would have been fought and won, and you'd be engaged in a naval arms race with your erstwhile allies, the U.S. and Japan. And it goes through, and you just read it, and you're like, it's a case for, right, not going all in on one course of action because right. as he develops. And so I reached out to him and he's going to come on All Marine Radio and talk about this. And so,
good catch, man.
Yeah, no, but I mean, when you read it, I have it like booming in my head, like a, you know, like a bass drum, you know, in a marching band, this whole predictive failure thing. And his just very simple way he laid it out. And so I asked him, would you be interested in coming on? So I just wanted to thank Will publicly for introducing me to that. And I'll include
There's
it
always
in
a
this
first.
Book.
A first, thank you.
What?
I got to note the time.
Really? We're going to go there? Here I'm so nice, and then you shove it right in my face. What the fuck?
I'm also amused that you're so just mad saying, at Tim for being yeah. on mute. We've been trying to put him on mute for 25 years.
I know, but we didn't realize that the best way to get him to mute him is to get him to put himself on mute. Now Jeff's even saying, you got to take yourself off mute.
That's yeah. Well, I mean, I know he's talking. We just can't hear him.
Tim? Crickets.
Hey, cricket. Tim is off mute, unresponsive right now.
All right.
Hey, I'm learning my lesson, man. It only took me, what, three
well,
months?
Well, we said, good. I told you, get a little sign when you hit the mute button, put the sign on the keyboard, and that way it's in front of you, and then when you go to talk, you'll say, oh, gotta unmute myself, right?
Yeah, I got this stupid pop blocker, and it's so I can't see the light that's blinking when it's muted because it's blocked by this little screen, so I don't pop when I talk to you. But hey, man, I'm getting the hang of it, boys. There's no reason to deflect
Tim,
over
remember.
To me.
It
doesn't, I'm being pressured.
It doesn't appear.
Come on, Tim,
it doesn't.
Remember.
Yeah, it doesn't appear.
Tim,
you're getting the hang
nothing,
of it.
Admit nothing. Deny everything. Make counter accusations.
That's right.
No.
I wasn't.
Hey,
it
I know
sounds
exactly
like this. I
here.
Wasn't.
I'm just trying to be civil.
It sounds like this. I wasn't on mute. Mac
pots me down on that shit, okay? So it's Mac that's fucking with me, and I think the rest of you guys should be on mute.
So there you go.
It sounds something like that.
You know, you're absolutely that. I misplayed that entirely. That's a good point.
Well, after it happens for like, you know, the third time in one show, I mean, I would do something to deflect, right? The criticism that you know is coming.
Yeah, I'm getting rusty out here down here in South Texas, buddy. I'm not frequenting and having social conversations enough, no doubt. Which is why I really appreciate. Well, I love doing this every week.
Well, let me.
You're right. That keeps you sharp. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying, man.
Whatever I can do, boys, to keep you guys sharp, it's I feel it's my moral responsibility. So, thank you, thank you, thank you. Will, thank you. Tim, thank you. Jeff, thank you very much.
Tashakur to you.
More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.